Isn't the Dharma fabulous? Don't you think the Dharma is fabulous? I'm assuming you do because you're here. I just think it's so amazing, right? It can just shift us doing the Dharma, meaning the practices, doing a meditation, or any of the other eightfold practices, the eightfold from the eightfold path of practices of integrity and speech, right? Like all these, isn't the Dharma amazing? And then the teachings too, like the teachings just can make such a difference in our life. That Dharma talk sometimes that we need so much, and it's just the thing that we need. So I definitely think of myself as a co-learner in this situation. I love to teach because it allows me the opportunity, or requires me in some ways, the opportunity to continue to study and practice the Dharma. So it's quite a gift that that we get to do this together. And that everybody's welcome. You're all welcome. It doesn't matter what shape you're in, mentally, physically, it doesn't matter. We're all welcome here. And that we can practice together in this way is quite a blessing. So I just like to think of myself as a co-learner. And thank you so much also for the generosity of this group, the Donna. It's really heartwarming too. So I took in the theme of this co-learner thing that we're all learning Dharma together and that we do this together actually quite well. So often I study on my own, but I do like to take courses and classes sometimes. So I signed up in January for there's actually IMS, Insight Meditation Society, which is the sister center to Spirit Rock, is having a 9-month program on mindfulness. And you can do 1 month at a time, or you can do all 9. So if you're interested, it's online. So you don't have to even go to Massachusetts. It's right. You can be in your own home in your bedroom if you want it. So you can sign up for 1 month at a time or the whole thing. So I signed up for January, and the teacher in January was Christina Feldman, who I just really adore how she frames things. And she said this thing, which I'm going to say to you, which kind of it just blew my mind. It maybe won't blow your mind, but it did blow my mind. She said that a chip that our practice, that spiritual practice, that our Buddhist practice is not about, so it's not about chipping away at the rock face of our faults. That spiritual practice is not about chipping away at the rock face of our faults, of our neuroses. She said, instead, it is a willingness to cultivate the wholesome, the beautiful. It is a willingness to cultivate the qualities that lead to freedom, that lead to the end of suffering. Isn't that amazing? It's such a different frame because so often we sit down, we're going to fix ourselves, we're gonna fix whatever the thing is that's the problem. But she's saying, no. Instead, let's turn and cultivate the wholesome, which we do in meditation. You just did in meditation. It might not feel like it, but we're cultivating equanimity and patience and generosity and compassion and effort. I mean, so many things when we sit down and do a meditation practice. So some years ago, maybe 10 years ago, maybe even a little longer. You know, I've been teaching yoga and Dharma and meditation for a long time, like decades. But about 10 years ago, I wanted to and was being asked to bump up where I was teaching and how I was teaching and what I was teaching. So I had like my comfort zone, and I was being asked to increase that. In part, I was asking myself. And I had a lot of anxiety. I don't know if you're familiar with anxiety. You're probably familiar with anxiety. It seems to be an epidemic, actually. But at any rate, I was having a lot of anxiety about this, and I wanted to find a way to support myself in my teaching. And I thought, oh, I got to work on this problem. I got to work on my anxiety. So I found a therapist, like we do in California, many of us, and or all over the world, really. I found a somatic therapist, and I told her, like, oh, I'm having all this anxiety around teaching. I love to teach, but I'm feeling a little limited. And so I want to work on my anxiety. And so I started going to her, and I went to her, oh, probably 2.5 years. And at the beginning, every week I would go. I'd be like, okay, we're going to talk about my anxiety this week. And then she would somehow turn the conversation she'd like ask, like a very talented therapist that she was, she would ask, like, oh, when did you feel good when you were teaching? And how did it feel in your body? And what happened? So for 2.5 years, instead of working on my anxiety, we instead paid attention to the wholesome quality of confidence. Because actually, confidence is a wholesome quality. We can't do anything without some sense of trust and confidence. And eventually we did start, but it was a long time to talk about the anxiety a little more directly. But somehow, by turning towards the wholesome quality, the problem lessened, like my grip on my anxiety problem lessened. And there was that sense of that growing confidence without ever having to address the problem in that sort of chipping away at that rock face of that problem that I've had for so long. I don't know if you've had that experience, right? Right. And instead, our Dharma practice is turning us towards the wholesome. So rather than working on what's broken or difficult, we turn towards that which leads to freedom. So the wholesome qualities, which are sometimes also named as beautiful qualities. So these beautiful qualities that lead us to freedom, these beautiful qualities that support ease in our life, compassion, investigation, effort, equanimity. There's so many, right? Kindness. So we start to soften the preoccupation with the problems and instead turn towards the wholesome. So we're holding our problems. So sometimes we still might need to address a problem. Like maybe you still want to work on something, but instead of having the frame of it being this monolith thing that we need to chip away at it, instead of having a sense of working on whatever the problem is out of shame, our guilt, our blame, our judgment, we hold ourselves in love. We hold ourselves in love. So Maya Angelou said, it is only love which sets us free. It is only love which sets us free. So I was teaching on metta, which is one of my ongoing favorite topics. I've probably taught on metta in this group more than once. I was teaching on metta and I was looking at the little graph. Maybe some of you have seen, like, there's a little graph that's got like the proximate cause and the near enemy and the far enemy, like all this, like a graph. It's very sort of listy and graphy. And the proximate cause for metta on my little graph, my chart, the proximate cause. So everything that arises due to so many different causes, so many different conditions. But the condition that is the closest or the one that's most needed for friendliness or loving kindness or love, metta, to arise. So the proximate cause for that is seeing the beautiful qualities in yourself or other. So for metta to arise, one of the causes is to see the proximate causes, to see the lovableness, to see the beautiful in yourself or someone else. So I was thinking about that and I was like, That means there has to be a willingness to let go of the obsession with the faults. Have you ever had this? Be upset with someone and then the mind's like, oh, all the things that are wrong with that person again and again. Or we do this to ourselves too. It's actually devastating that we do this culturally, that it's so common, because it's really painful and not so productive, that sort of looping obsession on the faults. So the proximate cause of friendliness, of loving kindness, of metta, is seeing the beautiful qualities. So that is, by definition, a willingness to let go of the obsession with the negative. So we're asked to soften our preoccupation with the negative. So we're abandoning all that obstructs. We're abandoning all that obstructs, rather than working with the difficult, the flawed, and the problematic, because that could be actually an endless project. I don't know. There's a lot of difficult, right? It could be a very endless project. But instead, we're abandoning all that obstructs. So our spiritual practice is a cultivation of the wholesome rather than a clinging to the negative. So the other day, I was on a walk with a friend. And I love to go on walks with my friends in nature. It's quite expansive. And there was some problem in my mind that I was, you know, going on, because it's actually really beautiful to share your problems with your friends. It's, it can be intimate. It can be helpful to do that in nature. But something happened. It was a really beautiful day and I was up on a hill. So maybe there's a sense of spaciousness with the view. But something happened and I just suddenly, like, the whole thing just stopped. Like the problem solving, like the whole thing just stopped. And this song came in my head. Do you know this song from The Sound of Music? How do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you catch a cloud and pin it down? She is gentle. She is wild. She's a riddle. She's a child. She's a headache. She's an angel. And I was thinking about that, like, oh, this is all of us, right? Like all of us were angels and headaches at once. And our life is like this too. It's it can be delightful, but then maybe like you're on a hike and it's beautiful, but your feet got too wet because it's been raining so much. Or maybe something really beautiful is happening in your life, but at the same time, there's some chronic illness happening. So our life is like that, right? It's full. It's all of it. And sometimes we don't need to solve all of the problems because like Maria in the song, Maria is unsolvable. Life is unsolvable. It's bigger and beautiful and we can't pin it down. So in some ways, our practice is about the cultivation of those moments when we let go of the struggle, when we let go and there's release. So what leads to freedom? If we're not focusing on the problems, but instead we're focusing on the qualities that lead to freedom, where do we start? So we do start with our mindfulness meditation. That's a big, big thing that we do in this tradition. When we practice mindfulness meditation, we're cultivating and practicing a whole family of beautiful qualities. So mindfulness never stands alone. It's part of a whole grouping of supportive, wise qualities that are onward leading, that are leading us towards freedom. So in this class with Christina Feldman, she gave from the text, from the suttas, a whole bunch of teaching metaphors about mindfulness, which I thought were really interesting. And I'm going to give you some of them that she gave me in this class. So she said that mindfulness is like, can be, so this is a teaching metaphor. She said that in the suttas, in the text, that mindfulness sometimes was talked about as like a person standing on a watchtower with a panoramic view. That this includes the fullness of the view, non-preferential and inclusive. And this is pointing to the quality of equanimity that gets developed when we're meditating, this quality of non-preferential, inclusive to whatever is arising. Conversely, there's another teaching metaphor of a farmer. Now, I don't know how many of you are farmers with the plow, like let alone like not even a tractor, right? An old-fashioned plow, but here it is. Here's the metaphor. We can understand it anyway. A farmer plowing a field where the farmer is standing on the plow and needs to know the right amount of effort so that the furrows where the seeds are going to be planted, the furrows not too deep and not too shallow. So the farmer, right? So the metaphor here is our effort with our mindfulness, not too deep, not too shallow. So the effort is balanced. so that the seeds of mindfulness can thrive. Another metaphor is that mindfulness is like a surgeon. So a doctor, a surgeon's probe that's palpitating to make a diagnosis in order to understand the problem, the prognosis, to prescribe the treatments. So in this metaphor of mindfulness, what's being pulled out is the quality of investigation. Like, what's going on here? Another one, there were so many, there's actually like pages and pages. I'm not going to give you all of them, but just to point out how mindfulness is not necessarily any one thing. It's a whole family of qualities. So another one is a cow herder metaphor. The cow herder is watching over the cows in the springtime to make sure the cows don't trample all the baby seedlings, the crops. And this is focus, the quality of focus. So the cow herder has to be paying attention, right? This quality of mindfulness has embedded in it, you would say, a quality of focus. Or in contrast, another metaphor is it's like mindfulness is like a cow herder in the fall. After the crops have been harvested, the cow herder gets to sit under a tree and knowing that it's fine to let the cows wander around a little bit. I think in this metaphor, the cows are the thoughts. I don't know how you take it, right? Like sometimes our mindfulness has a sense of trust or confidence and just allowing the cows to go this way and that when it's the right time. Mindfulness has embedded in it kindness and care. The metaphor given for this one is like a parent caring for an ill child. A parent caring for an ill child. My mom told me a story this week. I have two brothers, of how 1 month when I was 6, 4, and 2, so there were three of us, 6, 4, and 2, and how for a full month we had all of us kids, chicken pox, and then the flu, and so we were all sick for a month, and how, and so this metaphor, I can really see this metaphor of mindfulness being like a parent caring for an ill child, so I'm sure my mother didn't want to have to care for three of us for a month, but that's what arose, and so that's what was happening, that sense of love, that kindness embedded in it. So these teaching metaphors for mindfulness, this quality of attention that brings with it these family of wholesome qualities that when we sit down to meditate, I mean, there's so many more, right? Like we can think of patience or generosity can arise in our meditation practice, forbearance. There's so many things, resolve. And they're here for us. We're developing them when we practice. So we have in one of the lists, one of these Buddhist lists, is the 7 awakening factors, the Sata Sambhojanga. So you could say one way of looking at our practice is to identify and strengthen these 7 awakening factors. So the qualities that we're cultivating to develop freedom from suffering. So, the 7 awakening factors. The first one is mindfulness. The Pali word for mindfulness is sati, S-A-T-I. And Pali is the language that the Buddha was teaching in. Sati, S-A-T-I. And that word means to recollect. So when we're practicing mindfulness, we're recollecting what we're doing. We're remembering that we're sitting down. We're remembering what's important. We're remembering compassion. We're remembering. So this first one is mindfulness. The second one is investigation. Dhamma Vichaya. Do you want me to spell it? D-A-M-M-A. VICAYA, Dhamma Vichaya, investigation. Remember, that's the one of the surgeon probing someone to see what the injury is, what's the prognosis, what's the prescription, right? This is investigation. The next one is translated sometimes as effort or energy, and it's virya, V-I-R-I-Y-A, V-I-R-I-Y-A, or effort. So that's the one where the person, the farmer, is standing on the plow and modulating the effort. And then the next one is joy, or sometimes translated as rapture. Piti, P-I-T-I. Isn't that interesting that we're cultivating the wholesome in this practice and that joy is one of those? I think that's a beautiful thing. The next one is relaxation or tranquility, which is pasadi. P-A-S-S-A-D-D-H-I. P-A-S-S-A-D-D-H-I. It's this kind of calmness, relaxation, peacefulness. And then the next one is concentration or focus. I've also heard Ajahn Suchito talk about this one as absorption. And I really love that translation, absorption. It seems less effortful to me to be absorbed. But anyway, and that one is samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, S-A-M-A-D-H-I. And then the last one is equanimity, upekkha, that understanding that everything changes, taking in the bigger view, equally near all things. That's equanimity, upekkha. Oh, should I spell that one too? I know not everybody's writing, but I see some of you. U-P-E-K-K-H-A. I think it has two K's. U-P-E-K-K-H-A. Yeah, some of you are nodding. Good. Okay, so I'm going to go through that list again a little slower and talk about them just a little bit. You know, sometimes just hearing about the quality can be really helpful because then you can notice it. So this sense of mindfulness, this one of the strengths of mindfulness is when we hold something wholesome or beautiful quality in our awareness, just the awareness, the holding that in awareness allows it to grow stronger, right? So I'll talk about these. And so you can maybe notice them when they come this week in your life or when they pop up here and there, or maybe in your meditation practice when they pop up. So again, that turning towards the wholesome. So the first one, Dhamma Vichaya, this is investigation. It does include a sort of intellectual reflection. Like sometimes we might investigate or know something intellectually, but it's not always just intellectual. It's can be quite experiential. So for example, like sometimes I might, let's see if I can think of an example to explain what I mean is not just intellectual. So say something's happening. Oh, okay. Well, we'll see. Say something's happening and it's causing a little bit of suffering. And we might know like, I learned in Marin Sangha, or I learned in my studies that my suffering's coming from my clinging, wanting things to be different than they are. And so we kind of tell ourselves that, like, oh, just let go. It's very intellectual, right? Like, oh, I should just let go of this thing. Like, I know I'm suffering. I got to let go. And sometimes that will happen. We can do that intellectually and the clinging will just dissipate. But sometimes it doesn't. And we have to learn things again and again and again so we can investigate And then the insight of, oh, this is suffering. Suffering is to be felt, right? Like this is suffering is to be known, really. And so that we can then hold that. And then it filters through. Does that make sense? I'm not sure I'm being exactly clear, but maybe later someone will have an example for me. They can, you all can help me out because I know you know about this. How sometimes our insights can be intellectual, can be a kind of reflection, but there also can be a sense of it coming through the body. And this sense how we need to learn things again and again and again so it settles down. So the Dhamma Vichaya, this investigation, is the forerunner of awakening. We could think of it as a kind of affectionate inquiry. We could think of it as a discernment. Here, this is a good example. Discernment. This is wholesome. This is leading towards wholesome, onward leading. And this is unwholesome, unskillful. Like, when I'm obsessing over someone's faults, I can notice, oh yeah, this is not leading where I want to go, right? And I can discern that difference. So that Dhamma Vichaya, that investigation. Okay, the next one is Virya. The etymology of this is similar to the word virility. Vitality. It could mean courage, fearlessness, a willingness, our efforts, a forbearance. It's such a maybe old-fashioned word, forbearance, a diligence. It could also be a kind of ardency, our passion, a passionate interest. I don't know if any of you have sat retreat. It takes some interest, right? Some sort of interest to put your money and time, your life force into sitting a retreat. That kind of interest. The courage, it's a longing. It's our longing to be awake. With this courage, we have a sense of direction and possibility. We also are willing with our virya, with our courage, we're willing to bear discomforts. Meditation's not always pleasant. Have you noticed that yet? Right? It's not always pleasant, our meditation, right? And we are willing when we sit down to meditate to bear that discomfort. Our virya, our courage, is a quality that allows us to stand in the middle of dukkha. When we meet moments of struggle, when it seems unbearable, our courage takes us through. Sometimes swimming against the tide of our impulses, swimming against the tide of our anger, swimming against the tide of cultural norms, this all takes virya, this quality of courage and effort and fearlessness. We see virya in any social movement for justice, any and all of them. Then the next one is piti, P-I-T-I, joy, enthusiasm, rapture, happiness. So sometimes we hear these words, rapture and enthusiasm, and it can be that sort of intense level, but it doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't have to be dramatic or intense. This is a path of happiness. It's an abiding, it's a practice. Like all of these things are practices. They're not perfect. None of this is perfect, but they are practices that we can cultivate. It's like that sense when I was on the hike and all the problems, just for a moment, my attachment to them softened. And there was just that, I think I probably laughed. And then I started singing the Maria song and there it is, right? Like those moments that we all have, that piti, enthusiasm, rapture. We're invited to find joy in the undertaking of the path. You know, studying Dharma lights me up. That's a quality of happiness. Maybe it does for you too. Our joyfulness does not exclude sadness, right? This is life. They can live side by side. They can come together. And then the next one, the sadhi, relaxation or tranquility, serenity. It's calming, it's stilling, it's grounding. Our meditation practice, we're calming our bodies. You might have heard these instructions before to calm. We calm ourselves. We're calming our agitation. We learn through practice. It can be quite difficult even after some practice, but especially at the beginning, I think it can be quite difficult. We have to learn to go into places of stillness. We have to learn to be with calm in the body. Learn to calm the body and then learn to appreciate it. So we're letting go of, in some ways, the addiction to intensity. This quality is related to disenchantment, where we're withdrawing from the projected promises of happiness somewhere out there in the world, and instead finding our own inner calmness, serenity, tranquility. I think many of us come to the practice because we long for that. We long to just have some peace. Okay, and then the next one, samadhi. Absorption. Did you ever read a book or get really lost in doing art or playing music or reading, and then time just goes? That sense of absorption. It's to collect together, this word, samadhi. It's not necessarily about concentration, like furrowing the brow and locking down, but it's actually a gathering together, body, mind, in the present moment, coming to be in one place at one time, doing what you're doing while you're doing it. You could think of it as how we move through the world to not be so scattered. You know, this thing has happened to me since the cell phones, where now, if I'm down in the city and I'm driving a lot in traffic and I get to a stoplight, I somehow have to pick my phone up. Maybe this is embarrassing to admit, right? Like, I can't even sometimes just sit in the car, right? Like that sense of scatteredness, like, oh, what's the ding on the machine and who sent me an email and what's the news, right? Like, we're distracted in so many places at once. And the samadhi is a kind of coalescence of bringing all the different strands of us, the different parts of us together in the same place at the same time, samadhi. And then upekkha, the last one, equanimity. It's not just a state, not an emotional state necessarily, but it's an understanding that all of us are in the middle of our lives. We're in the middle of everything. It's an understanding that we are not always in control of outcomes. We're not helpless either, but we're not always in control of outcomes. That life goes up and down, even in one meditation, life goes up and down, our experience, pleasure and pain, blame and loss, blame and fame, or whatever the eight are. So this quality of equanimity is a way of meeting life as it is, where we stand right in the middle of things. So with our practice, with our practice of mindfulness, it's actually quite inspiring to me that it's not about chipping away and like fixing all your faults. It's actually about turning towards these wholesome qualities, that we're cultivating them. This list, these seven awakening factors, these are to be developed for our ease and spaciousness in life, not just in our meditation practice, but in life. We can see how they can all support us, that we're turning towards the wholesome, that we can have the confidence, maybe do you have the confidence that something that we practice It's something that we can practice and develop these eight or seven qualities. All right, that's what I have for you all. Thank you for listening to me. I'm wondering, we have some time and I just love to hear, in particular, of course, want to hear your questions because so much gets brought out when there's questions, like things I didn't explain well or things that maybe you have a different understanding of. And so questions are always welcome, but then also any thoughts or like if there's anything about investigation or any of the other qualities that you have experience with that you know about that might be helpful for me or for others in the group. I really just want to give a little bit of time to hear from you if anybody had anything. And if you can, just unmute yourself if you'd like.
Hi, Ashley.
Hi.
I really liked the part you were talking about, the relaxation. And a lot of my practice was so like, I have to force myself to be relaxed. How do I let go of this stress and just, okay, relax the shoulders. And, you know, what I've been learning about is that in order to cultivate any relaxation, I have to have compassion for myself and learn how to self-soothe, you know? Mm-hmm. So that made a big difference for me, is learning, you know, how to relax without too much, you know, grip on it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you for bringing in compassion. That's actually really, really beautiful. And how it's the same, like if anybody has insomnia, like trying to force ourselves to sleep, it's a disaster. Like forcing ourselves to relax, like we can create the conditions. This is one of the reasons why I love the Buddha's teachings around that conditions lead to outcomes. So causes lead to outcomes. And you're saying for you, and I think probably for many of us, me included at least, I'll speak for me, that in order to relax for that tranquility, there needs to be compassion. So that's one of the conditions. It's like when I'm gardening, I can't force that tomato. I have to create the conditions. So we can't force the tranquility. We need the conditions. And maybe the proximate cause, to use that language that I was using in Metta, the proximate cause for tranquility is some self-compassion. Thank you. That's really helpful.
Welcome. Hi, Ashley. Thank you. I really appreciate too this piece about, you know, you, not spending all your time trying to fix yourself, but putting your energy where you put your energy, where you put your focus, and your energy follows where you, and so focusing on cultivating the wholesome and sort of, it's almost renunciating, you know, this focus on the things that I want to fix about myself and the things that I am self-critical about, or and with others as well, and trying to find the beauty in self and others. So I really appreciated that. And I think that's a reminder that I need daily. So anyway, I appreciated that focus for tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Corey. That is straight from Christina Feldman. I will not own that one because she really that blew my mind in January. It's just, and to have that connection too with, oh, the metta, the proximate cause of the loving kindness is to see the lovable. And then that's what we're doing. In some ways, we're seeing the beautiful qualities, these seven, or, you know, any wholesome, beautiful quality. It's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Thank Christina. We'll have to send her a little note. Yeah. Mary.
So the piece that you were talking about investigation and looking at discernment. So one of the things I've been playing with, and it's just so funny, is the difference between judging and discernment. So that's been kind of a fun thing to look at in my life lately. So, yeah. But one of the things I have found is that when I'm trying to discern something, it's if I'm too much up here, then I start going to narrative And actually, I'm getting away from whatever it is that I'm trying to pay attention to. And I have found that if I can be more grounded, be more in my body, to drop in more, and actually, what does this feel like? You know, what's where is it? You know, where is the felt sense of things in my body? I mean, sometimes, you know, images will crop or pop up or things like that will come up. But I find now that if I, you know, it's like so much for me, the Dharma starts up here and then it moves down. And when I kind of get it in the whole mind body place and I can just sit with whatever it is, like, the feeling of remorse, the feeling of shame, without doing a whole thing about yada, 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 the story, the story, the story, but just how does this feel? And for me, a lot of times it's kind of like, you know, what Sherry talked about. A lot of times, like, compassion will come up because, you know, when things are really difficult and unpleasant, that's really needed to sit with it. And I just remember our teacher who's passed away, Wendy Palmer, had talked about how, you know, when we're doing mindfulness practice, like, I mean, the crap that comes up, you need to have that open heart and that compassion with it. And the only way I know that I'm having that is if I'm really grounded in my body and feeling that. And I find for me, that is probably it's one of the things that lets me be with stuff that would rather just sweep under the rug. And then I just trip over it later on in my life. And it's not good. Not good at all.
Right.
So thank you.
It's really, yeah. I think that's interesting. In, I think that's really interesting to think about too, like this quality of samadhi, which is maybe something we might think of as something over there, but to talk about samadhi as a gathering together, and you're talking about bringing the mind and the body together, so that's gathering, so that there's coalescence or that unity, so the body and the mind are on the same page. So I think that's really beautiful. And then maybe another time, but I'm really curious about the difference between discernment and judgment. Isn't that a beautiful topic? I think that's probably something we could all study for a long time, the difference between discernment and judgment. Yeah. Is there anybody else? We have time maybe for one more. Yeah, go ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, this could be a trivial question, but I'm really curious. In the list of the seven factors, why piti is chosen and not sukha? I mean, piti is this energetic joy or rapture, and then there's sukha, there's this contentment. And is there a reason that?
The only thing I don't, this is total my supposition. I don't know this because I've been taught this or read it anywhere. Mindfulness is the balancing. And so we've got the energizing and the calming. So on the one side, we have investigation, effort, and PT. And so those are the upward flowing energy and then the tranquility. Because I think of sukha as more on the downward flowing.
I think that's sukha wonderful. That's a wonderful.
They should have made it eight factors.
Right, yeah.
Put sukha in there.
Yeah, right, yeah. Put sukha in there. Right. Put mindfulness on top. But anyway, yeah. That's a good answer though for PT. I wish they had sukha on it. But
yeah. Yeah, but Christina, she definitely said that it's not always dramatic or intense. So that's where I'm getting that from, because my understanding of PT also is that it's very, can be actually even unpleasant. It's so intense, but she said it doesn't have to be that way. It can be an abiding or a joyfulness or more. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. I want to make sure I'm not, if there is anybody had anything else that we don't leave anyone out. Good. Oh, Deborah, let's hear from you, Deborah. I haven't heard from you yet.
I just wanted to say I love your haircut and thank you for that talk. And I was having a conversation with a friend. She used to be the executive director of Dharma Seed, and I met her through volunteering at Spirit Rock probably 20 years or more ago. And she's kind of another Buddhist teacher for me. And we were talking yesterday, I guess, about, you know, all the horrible things that are going on in the world. And, you know, sometimes hard to be equanimous or optimistic or hopeful. And we kept returning to, you know, practice and using practice and holding everything and, you know, keeping faith and all of that. So you using the word discernment tonight somehow just resonated so strongly for me, because I think that's a really perfect word to kind of wrap up what we were doing yesterday for 2 hours on the phone. Just, you know, having that balance that you were just talking about, where I can be aware and I can contribute as much as I can contribute in whatever ways I'm able, but not get caught and not get clingy and not get aversive and come back to my body. And, you know, as Mary was also mentioning, and for me, this is, I'm sure for everybody, very important, is to notice what's going on in my head and then come back to my body and to have this self-compassion. And I'll just say one more thing, to have some balance. I was listening to Dr. Richard Schwartz. I don't know if anybody knows him. He's a psychotherapist, psychologist, and he developed something called family, I can't remember, FS, family system something. And he was talking about parts. And I think what you've been talking about tonight is parts, all of our parts. And how, what, so what I've started to do is to talk to my parts, which really I think I've been doing anyway, but I've kind of ramped it up. And having compassion for those parts, as some of us have mentioned tonight, of the crap that goes on in my head and probably other people's heads, not my crap, but their crap in their heads. And yeah, so this just, I mean, this, you're amazing. I love you. Thank you. This is, was fabulous tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Deborah. Thank you.